Iran's President Hassan Rouhani urges the next U.S. administration to compensate for the wrong policies pursued by Donald Trump. French police and people clash in Bordeaux during a protest against a new law banning the dissemination of images of police officers' faces. Also in the headlines, the head of the European Commission says that the Union will not compromise on the integrity of its market for a post-Brexit trade deal with Britain. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani says that he expects the next U.S. administration to compensate his country for the wrong policies pursued by Donald Trump over the past 4 years. Rouhani said that President Donald Trump's failure to win a second term was the result of his wrong policies. The Iranian president said that those policies included issues like coronavirus pandemic and racism. Rouhani said Trump's foreign policies also contributed to his defeat in the November 3rd election. The Iranian president said that his country's policies are based on reciprocal respect and commitment. He said that if the next U.S. administration respects this, the way would be clear to return to conditions prior to January 2017. That's when Trump took office. Political commentator John Stepling believes that the U.S. approach toward Iran will not change in the long term.
But I think that Rouhani's right that Biden is going to reengage on the JCPOA in some fashion or other. He may back off the sanctions. But U.S. foreign policy, by and large, doesn't change. Given that a lot of the European allies want the U.S. to reengage with Iran, they want to be able to do business with Iran, there's going to be a huge incentive for Biden to bend in ways that Pompeo and Trump didn't. But that's probably short-term thinking. Long-term, not much is really going to change, and Iran will continue to be stigmatized and unfairly singled out because Western foreign policy needs a villain, and right now that villain is Iran.
Clashes are broken up between police and protesters in the French city of Bordeaux. The demonstrators set fire to trash cans, smashed store windows, and tagged walls. The protest was the latest in nationwide demonstrations against the new security law. Proposed legislation would criminalize the dissemination of images of police officers unless their faces are blurred. Those found guilty would be imprisoned or receive fines. Activists have denounced the law as a violation of press freedom. Excessive use of force by French police has come under scrutiny. It came after a series of incidents were captured on video and shared on social media platforms. Taxi drivers have brought the Spanish capital to a standstill during a protest directed at the government over worsening working conditions due to the coronavirus crisis. Thousands of taxis parked up in a long queue around Madrid's famous landmarks, clogging the streets while honking. Taxi drivers complained that the local government had taken no heed to their demands. While expressing anger over policies, they urged local authorities to regulate the transport sector so that less taxi drivers work at the same time. The taxi sector is struggling with a declining demand since the start of the pandemic due to restrictive measures. Spain is one of Europe's worst-hit countries by COVID-19. Like many other nations, the country's economy has suffered terribly due to the pandemic. The British Prime Minister has reiterated that London does not want to extend the current Brexit transition period. Boris Johnson said that he will not be asking for more time to negotiate a post-Brexit trade deal with the European Union. However, he urged the bloc to accept the reality that his country must control access to its waters if the two are eager to make progress in talks on fisheries. Earlier, the head of the European Commission warned that any post-Brexit trade agreement with London must not hurt the EU single market.
With very little time ahead of us, we will do all in our power to reach an agreement. We're ready to be creative, but we are not ready to put into question the integrity of the single market.
Ursula von der Leyen said the EU is prepared for a no-deal situation after the December 31st deadline. She urged London to accept what she called fair trade rules. Britain withdrew from the EU in January and is now in a transition period. The two sides are at loggerheads over the future of the trade ties, as some issues remain unresolved. The coronavirus pandemic keeps taking its toll on European countries as the number of fatalities and infections continues to rise. Russia on Wednesday reported a record 507 deaths in 24 hours. That takes Russia's overall fatalities to more than 37,500. The country's total cases are more than 2.1 million. Also on Wednesday, Germany registered a record 410 new deaths from the virus. That brings the country's total fatalities to nearly 15,000 out of more than 960,000 cases. And Germany is expected to extend a partial lockdown introduced in early November. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen has warned against relaxing lockdown measures too quickly. She says that there is a risk of a third wave of infections. Correspondent in Brussels, Jerome Hughes, says European governments are under tremendous pressure to get the economies moving again during the winter holiday season.
The problem now is that there authorities across the EU and in the UK, they're under massive pressure to try and to get the economies moving again for the holiday season in December when we approach Christmas. All the business operators, they want to be functioning. They say that this is the most important time of the year for them in terms of retail, in terms of hospitality. This is when they make their money because obviously, you know, normally January, February, March, April, even May would be very quiet months normally. So they really need this season. And so there's a lot of pressure on governments. But the health authorities are saying, if you do that, if you allow things to reopen, if you allow people to congregate together in these colder conditions with lack of ventilation indoors where the virus loves to spread, then we could potentially have a catastrophe in January, you know, the middle of January, when we see hospitals becoming overwhelmed. And of course, there is a concern as well that with the three here in the EU, three working vaccines likely in the next couple of weeks, there's a concern that there's complacency setting in, that people think, oh, well, the cure is on the way, and so we can relax. So all of this is making health authorities very concerned that what we're leading up here to and what we're building up to, you see restrictions being relaxed in the UK, for example, on the run-up around the end of December. So there's a big concern that we're going to see the results of that, then very negative impacts in January, and that is a major concern.
Iran's health minister Saeed Namaki says the Islamic Republic is planning to purchase about 42 million doses of COVID-19 vaccine from foreign companies. He did not specify the companies Iran is intending to get the vaccines from, but said around 21 million people would be vaccinated upon the procurement. He also revealed that one of a dozen domestic companies working on the coronavirus vaccine will start human tests from the next week. He said these vaccines are being developed based on international standards and are being verified by the World Health Organization. Meanwhile, Iran reported a daily record of over 13,800 COVID-19 cases, as well as 469 deaths on Wednesday. The number of total caseloads in the country has now surpassed 894,000, while the death toll topped 46,000. Human rights abuses in the European Union are on the rise, according to members of the European Parliament. Legislators from across the 27-nation bloc claim COVID-19 is exacerbating the problem. Jerome Hughes has more from Brussels.
A debate on fundamental rights in the EU has just concluded in the European Parliament. COVID-19 lockdowns and reduced access to services due to the pandemic have apparently made the elderly more vulnerable, and other groups too.
Women, children in poverty, and people with disabilities.
The 27-nation bloc's asylum system was castigated during the debate.
We have migrants left to rot and fester in camps, while boats of pregnant women and children are pushed out to sea by state forces in Greece. We have migrants raped with the branches of trees by state forces in Croatia. We have Muslims hounded in France.
It's claimed the EU's attitude towards refugees is facilitating abuses both within the bloc and in neighbouring countries.
Greece, Turkey, Poland, Belarus, Spain, Morocco, Hungary, Serbia, and in some countries, Croatia, they even face torture, humiliation, and sexual abuse.
Governments in EU nations, such as Czech Republic and Hungary, are fueling Islamophobia by the way they are dealing with the refugee crisis, according to experts.
They've sought to interpret that crisis as a one of Muslim invasion. And government narratives, when they're deployed in that way, can be very strong.
Other fundamental rights abuses in the EU are also being highlighted. Spanish authorities are criticised for imprisoning activists in Catalonia.
We spend all our time asking Hungary and Poland to act like genuine democratic states, but we don't do anything on Spain. Without civil and political rights, the European project is done for.
Some lawmakers accuse the EU of hypocrisy in terms of how it tries to export its values.
Let's just take one example, cozying up to Israel and Saudi Arabia, which have appalling human rights records, while at the same time imposing really tough sanctions against countries such as Russia and Iran. Jerome Hughes, the European Parliament, Brussels.
As EU leaders are considering to impose more sanctions on Turkey over the Eastern Mediterranean dispute, Turkey says that it will not give in to what it calls double standards amid months of tensions with Brussels. Thresh Saglan reports from Istanbul.
As the European Council is set to convene in December to discuss the tensions with Turkey, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has called for dialogue, but warned the EU not to become a tool for enmities during escalating tensions over the Eastern Mediterranean. In his latest statement on Turkey-EU ties, Erdogan said Turkey sees its future in Europe and mentioned Turkey's post-pandemic plans to improve judicial infrastructure and strengthen the economy and other reforms.
We see ourselves as an inseparable part of Europe, with which we share 600 years of historical bond. We're calling on the EU to create a closer bond with us, to keep the promise of full membership for Turkey. We see ourselves in Europe, not anywhere else. We aim to build our future with Europe.
Observers, however, say Turkey does not stand any chance to become an EU member, despite all negotiations.
In my opinion, the EU does not see Turkey either as a partner or a possible member of the bloc. For the EU, Turkey is only a trade ally. This means that neither now or in future, Turkey will not get closer to becoming an EU member.
Earlier this week, the EU's foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, said Turkey isn't sending positive signals and needs to change its attitude fundamentally regarding the hydrocarbon dispute with EU members Greece and Cyprus in the Mediterranean Sea. European leaders say they will watch for Turkey's steps in the next couple of weeks before discussing any potential sanctions in their upcoming summit. Turkey is still a candidate to become an EU member. The bloc decided to effectively freeze accession talks in June 2018 over disagreements on accession terms. Many here are pessimistic about the future of accession talks, despite Ankara's ongoing efforts to meet the EU's demands. Meanwhile, some economists even warn that the accession could harm Turkey's economy. Reshan Saglam, Istanbul.
The African Union has sent three envoys to Ethiopia to help resolve the ongoing deadly conflict in the country's northern Tigray region. Former presidents of Mozambique, Liberia, and South Africa are expected in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa, for talks with authorities there. That's hours before a government ultimatum for Tigray expires. Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed gave regional forces a 72-hour notice to surrender or face an offensive against their capital, Mekele. Abiy has said that he will receive the EU envoys but will not talk to Tigray regional leaders unless they surrender. Premier launched a military campaign against the Tigray People's Liberation Front on November the 4th, accusing it of attacking two federal military camps. Hundreds of people are reported to have been killed in nearly 3 weeks of fighting. Over 40,000 Ethiopians have also crossed the border into Sudan to save their lives. U.S. media say President Donald Trump plans to pardon his former national security advisor, who admitted lying to the FBI over his Russian contacts. Trump reportedly plans to include Michael Flynn in a series of pardons that he will issue during his last days of presidency. Flynn's secret contacts with the Russian ambassador to Washington was a key part of a probe into Russia's alleged meddling in the 2016 U.S. presidential election. Flynn pleaded guilty in 2017 to lying to the FBI about those contacts. He was fired by Trump less than a month into his administration. In May of this year, the Justice Department withdrew his case against Flynn, said his alleged lies to the FBI were not significant. Millions of Americans celebrate what's known as Thanksgiving Day. They mark this day to thank God for all the blessings provided to them. But this has all come at an expense. The rights and lands of the Native American Indians were violated and taken away, which is why, for American Indians, it's a day of mourning.
People in the United States celebrate on the fourth Thursday in November as Thanksgiving. The event was first celebrated by the Pilgrims after their first harvest in the New World in October 1621. It's usually remembered and celebrated as the prosperity and the fortune that the first pilgrims found in the new land. But for the continent's indigenous people, Thanksgiving was just the beginning of pillage and the destruction perpetrated in the service of European expansionism and white supremacy. Native Americans were greatly affected by the European colonization of the Americas, and their population declined precipitously due to introduced diseases, warfare, and slavery. For the last 51 years, the United American Indians of New England have organized a rally and day of mourning on Thanksgiving. Native Americans commemorate the event as the National Day of Mourning. They say it led to the genocide of millions of Native people, the theft of Native lands, and the relentless assault on Native culture. It is a day of remembrance and spiritual connection, as well as a protest of the racism and oppression which Native Americans continue to experience. After the founding of the United States, many Native American people were subjected to warfare, removals, and one-sided treaties, and they continue to suffer from discriminatory government policies into the 21st century.
It is important to note the crimes that the founding fathers of America committed against the Native American Indians, starting with this day. Now, this was followed by centuries of oppression, racism, and genocide. To this day, American Indians are still a victim, as evidenced in land grabs by U.S. companies. In order for the U.S. to compensate for the horrific crimes committed against these people, it has given special favors to their race, such as bank loans, college admissions, and employment. But this does not erase the bleak history of the sufferings of American Indians. Yet generations of Americans have been taught a one-sided history at homes and at schools.
Today, Native Americans in the United States belong to one of the most forgotten people who suffer from social neglect. It has long been recognized that Native Americans are dying of diabetes, alcoholism, tuberculosis, suicide, and other health conditions at shocking rates. Native Americans also suffer a significantly lower health status and disproportionate rates of disease compared with all other Americans. Native communities are impacted by some of the worst health outcomes of any race in the United States. Poor health amongst Native Americans is caused by many contributing factors, including high rates of poverty, isolated geography, poor education and nutrition, inadequate sewage disposal, and unhealthy living conditions. The serious issues with mental health among Native Americans are closely linked to other risk factors like high rates of violence, assault, and abuse. Lack of educational opportunity for Native Americans is a serious challenge that has impacted the success and health of Native communities for the long term. Much of this hopelessness is related to the poverty and lack of economic opportunity offered to Native American kids on reservations. Native Americans have the highest unemployment rates across the country, and Native Americans have the highest poverty rate at 27%. On some reservations, up to 85% of people are unemployed. It's been suggested that outgoing President Trump's rhetoric has emboldened the right-wing violence against Native Americans. Back in 2019, a group of young Trump supporters were filmed mocking a Native American leader in the state of Kentucky. The confrontation was interpreted as a symbol of rising violence against the Native population in the U.S.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Amir Kabir. Khayyam. Maulana. Avicenna. Khwarizmi. Iranian notables, sources of global honor.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, in this episode, you'll get more familiar with the Iranian poet who lived in 7th and 8th centuries A.H., corresponding to 13th and 14th centuries A.D. He was Seyf Faraghani. Seyf Faraghani has been known as a leader of socio-political poetry in Farsi language. The 7th and 8th centuries A.H. were among the bright eras of Iran's literary history, as masters of poetry and Gnosticism like Maulana, Saadi, and Hafez lived in that era. During the Mongol invasion, some regions in Iran remained intact against the pillage and destruction imposed by the invaders. This was mainly due to the wisdom of the local rulers. For instance, Fars region remained safe because it was under the rule of Sa'd ibn Zangi, Abu Bakr, and his sons. They were Solgari rulers who used to consort with the men of letters and were sponsors of artists and poets. Thus, the rule in the region coincided with thriving of knowledge and literature. Therefore, when Genghis Khan and Hulagu attacked the region, the entire region remained safe and secure, and as a safe haven, attracted a group of notables of the era as well. The acclaimed poet Saadi Shirazi has composed poems on the situation of the region in those days. Shams Ghais Razi, too, has explained his wandering in Khorasan and Iraq and asking the help of the great figures of Fars. He explains in details the efforts of Sa'd ibn Zangi's son for development and security of the region and the welfare of the people. The words of Shams Ghais, too, show that the Fars region and the ports and islands of the Persian Gulf were the examples of development, security, and flourishing during the Solgari rule. Another region that remained intact against the Mongol invasion was Asia Minor, which mainly consists of the current Turkey. This region was ruled by Seljuks as powerful kings. The Mongols managed to overcome them only when they had become too weak. In view of this,
Asia Minor used to function as a refuge for many scholars and learned from Iran. Many elites had covered one city after another to reach the region to live in security. Among these figures, mention can be made of paragons of the Farsi literature like Jalaluddin Muhammad Molavi or Maulana, Shams Tabrizi, Saifuddin Faraghani, and others. Each of these men was a great personality in mysticism and poetry. With regards to the fact that many of these migrants were Iranian thinkers, poets, and scholars, they took a lot of books with themselves. Hence, the Iranian culture and Farsi language were transferred to their region. Sham, or Greater Syria, and Egypt were other places that remained immune against the Mongol and even Tartar invasion. Thus, many great scholars migrated to the region and stayed there till the end of their life. The region beyond the Indus River, or Sindh, was another important safe haven for Iran's scholars and literary men. This region was under the rule of Ghur dynasty at that time. It soon turned into an important base of Farsi literature and Iranian sciences. The Ghur rulers were divided into the emirs of Sindh, emirs of Delhi, and emirs of Bengal. They had mainly been trained with Iranian culture. There was a big group of Iranians among the emirs of India who had either migrated to the region a little before the Mongol onslaught or concurrent with the events of Transoxiana and Khorasan. Nuruddin Muhammad Ofi was among the renowned Iranian poets who escaped from the Tartar onslaught to Sindh. Apart from these regions that were mentioned, there were other places where Iranian great men would gather, but we will not touch upon them. Dear listeners, next time we will continue the discussion.
Ocean of Dua.
Amma inni as'aluka al-huda wat-tuqa wal-'afafa wal-ghina.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear listeners, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Rarsi, and we're gonna be with you with another edition of the Ocean of Dua. In this version of the program, inshallah, we will discuss the true meaning of prayer and dua, the value of prayer, ways of reaching the Almighty Allah, acceptance, and also benefits of dua. So stay with us. So, dear listeners, Allah willing, in this program, we will finish talking about the things we shouldn't ask from the Almighty Allah in our supplications. Having a short review over what we said petition and contrary to the norms of the Almighty Allah in the universe and life is from among the things we shouldn't pray for to the Almighty Allah, as is praying for illegal things and wishing the eradication of blessings from the others, and also petition against the advantage of the supplicants.
Alhamdulillah, khaliq al-khalq, basit al-rizq,
فالق الإصباح ذي الجلال والإكرام والفضل والإنعام الذي بعد فلا يرى وقرب فشهد النجوى.
The last of what we were discussing was not to invoke evil upon the believers, since only those hearts which are filled with love are about to attract the Almighty Allah's mercy. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam narrates from his fathers and they from the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, when Allah the Blessed the Exalted sees the inhabitants of a city to have exceeded the boundaries in wrongdoing, while among them are three believers, then He the Majestic calls out to them, O you who disobey me, had it not been for the believers who are amidst you, loving each other under the shadow of my majesty, building my land and mosques with their prayers, and pleading for my forgiveness, I would have indeed sent down my punishment upon you. In this regard, also Jamil bin Darraj narrates from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, the love of a person for his brothers in faith is a merit for him near Allah. And he whom Allah inspires with the love of his brothers, then he is loved by Allah. And whosoever is loved by Allah, He will give him his reward in the full on the Day of Judgment. So, we would understand by now that loving hearts cause Almighty Allah's mercy to be sent down upon us. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, when the two believers meet each other and shake hands, Allah the Exalted sends down one part of mercy upon them, while another 99 parts of that mercy are for the one who is more ardent in his love for his brother. If they stand, the mercy embraces them, and if they sit to talk to each other, the guardian angels say to one another, move away from them, as they might be talking of a secret which Allah has concealed from us. In a rather long tradition, Ishaq bin Ammar reports from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, when two believers embrace each other, the mercy of Allah surrounds them, and if they continue to do so, not intending by it the transitory wares of the life of this world, it is said to them, you have been forgiven, so start afresh your life without sins. When they begin to inquire about each other, the angels say to one another, distance yourself from them, for they might have a secret which Allah has concealed from us. And as loving hearts cause the Almighty Allah's mercy, on the other hand, harboring deceit and grudge for the believers causes the wrath of Allah. And it is actually related to our subject, since it impedes the supplicant as well as his prayer from Allah when he harbors ghish or deceit for the believers.
Why do we make supplication? And why do we call out to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Is it because God is not aware of our needs? God is Al-Alim. He knows all of our needs. Is it because God needs convincing? God is known as Al-Jawad. He is the source of generosity. Then why am I making dua to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? The dua is a journey of realizations. When a person goes to the ocean and he takes with him a bucket that can carry 4 liters of water, the ocean is infinite. In as much as your vessel is large, that is the amount of water that the ocean will give you. And therefore, our goal is to expand our capacity. Rumi has a very beautiful poem. He says, Har khujo mushkil javab onjo ravad. Wherever there is a problem, that is where the answer will come. Har khujo keshti onjo ravad. Wherever there is a vessel, that's where the water will come. Ab kamju tishnagi avar bedas. Don't go seeking for water. Instead, create the thirst within you. Ta beju shad avaz balav asta. So that the water may burst forth from above and from below you. experience that realization that you need God, and the mercy will, God will come towards you.
Paradise, thank you Allah, let me hear, feeling so good, about all the things that we went through, knowing that God speaks with us too, it's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever.
The ocean of dua.
The Holy Prophet ﷺ has said, "He who spends a night while he has in his heart some kind of deception towards his Muslim brother, then he has spent the night in the wrath of Allah, and he shall enter the morning in the wrath of Allah, unless he pleads for forgiveness and returns to the right conduct. And if he dies on the same state, he has died on a religion other than Islam." So Allah never likes the two believers who are having grudge or any kind of deceit in their minds, and Allah never looks at those who hate the believers. As the last tradition regarding this matter, Imam Ali alayhi salam narrates from the Holy Prophet, "The wicked of the people is he who hates the believers and is hated by them, those who cause a split between the beloved ones. They are those whom Allah shall not look at, nor shall he purify on the day of judgment." Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight. Throughout his time as U.S. Senator and Vice President, Joe Biden was notoriously pro-war. He's expected to surround himself with a cadre of right-wing hawks. Former third-ranking U.S. War Department official, its highest-ever-ranking woman, co-founder of the Neoconservative Center for a New American Security, War of Terror backer Michelle Flourney, is expected to be named Biden-Harris regime war secretary. According to Bloomberg News, on Sunday, 22nd of November, Tony Blinken, longtime Biden foreign policy advisor, is expected to be named as the incoming Secretary of State. Blinken, Flourney, and Joe Biden backed all U.S. new millennium preemptive wars on non-belligerent nations, threatening no one. Perpetual war under phony pretext of supporting world peace and stability appears to be taking shape as one of the centerpieces of the presumptive Biden-Harris geopolitical agenda. We're prepared for you an article written by Stephen Lenman, a Chicago-based author, research associate of the Center for Research on Globalization, and host of the Progressive Radio News Hour. The piece is titled Biden Surrounding Himself with a Cadre of Right-Wing Hawks. Please stay with us for more of Stephen Lenman's article. Throughout most of the Second World War period, permanent war on invented enemies has been official U.S. policy. Since Woodrow Wilson, the 28th President of the United States, involved this country in the First World War, Democrats have been notoriously more belligerent than Republicans. Bush the First, Bush the Second, and Dick Cheney, major exceptions. Unlike most other Democrats, Jack Kennedy, the 35th President of the United States, transformed himself from a warrior to a purported peacemaker. He opposed Pax Americana, or American imperialism, supported nuclear disarmament, normalization with Soviet Russia, and respect for Palestinian rights. For these and other reasons, the CIA eliminated him on 22nd of November 1963. Pro-war Lyndon Johnson replaced Kennedy. A decade of Southeast Asia quagmire followed. Throughout his time as U.S. Senator and Vice President, Joe Biden was notoriously pro-war. He's expected to surround himself with a cadre of right-wing hawks. Former third-ranking U.S. War Department official, its highest-ever-ranking woman, co-founder of the Neoconservative Center for a New American Security, War of Terror backer Michelle Flourney, is expected to be named as Joe Biden and Kamala Harris administration's new Secretary of Defense. According to Bloomberg News, on Sunday, 22nd of November, Tony Blinken, longtime Biden foreign policy advisor, is expected to be named as the new Secretary of State. Blinken and Flourney and Joe Biden backed all U.S. new millennium preemptive wars on non-belligerent nations threatening no one. Perpetual war on a phony pretext of supporting world peace and stability appears to be taking shape as one of the centerpieces of the presumptive Biden-Harris administration's geopolitical agenda. Wars by other means against China, Russia, Iran, Venezuela, Cuba, North Korea, and other nations unwilling to subordinate their sovereign rights to U.S. interests are also likely to continue endlessly. Blinken and Flourney co-founded political strategy firm WestExec. Blinken was Vice President Biden's national security advisor
from 2009 to 2013. He was Barack Obama and Joe Biden's Deputy National Security Advisor from 2013 to 2015. From 2015 to 2017, he was Deputy Secretary of State. Time and again, he argued for tough diplomacy. If unable to achieve compliance with U.S. demands, he said military action is possible. An advocate of American exceptionalism, the indispensable nation, he said the following weeks earlier. On leadership, whether we like it or not, the world just doesn't organize itself. The U.S. always played a lead role in doing a lot of that organizing, helping to write the rules, to shape the norms and animate the institutions that govern relations among nations. Blinken said, when we're not engaged, when we don't lead, then one or two things is likely to happen. He added, either some other country tries to take our place, but probably not in a way that advances our interests or our values, or no one does. And then you get chaos or a vacuum filled by bad things before it's filled by good things. Either way, that's bad for us. Before the election, Tony Blinken said if Biden is elected, the first thing we have to dig out from a strategic deficit that Donald Trump has put us in, adding the incumbent helped China advance its own key strategic goals. A Democratic administration will step up Taiwan's defensive capabilities. We need to focus on readiness for whatever may come. On U.S. relations with the Israeli regime, he said Biden-Harris administration would not tie military assistance to Israel to any political decisions that it make, period, full stop. Support for its apartheid rule, occupation and theft of Palestinian land, along with cross-border hostilities, will continue unchanged. Last summer, Tony Blinken and said Joe Biden, if elected, will use the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, as a platform to try to build a stronger and longer deal working with U.S. partners, adding, the E3 countries and Brussels are likely to join us in trying to curb other actions by Iran that we find objectionable. Biden advisor Jake Sullivan called it impractical to think that the United States will provide significant sanctions relief without assurances that Iran will immediately begin negotiations on a follow-up the JCPOA agreement that at least extends the timelines of the deal and addresses issues of verification and intercontinental ballistic missiles. According to Bloomberg, he is expected to be named presumptive Biden-Harris administration national security advisor. Linda Thomas-Greenfield reportedly will be named United Nations envoy. She and Tony Blinken were involved in earlier JCPOA negotiations that produced the landmark agreement. Now it appears they want it hardened, notably to include restrictions on Iran's legitimate missile program. Under the United Nations Charter and other international law, the right of self-defense is inviolable. Iran's military, Iranian missiles and other weapons development are solely for defenses purposes only. The country is the region's leading proponent of peace, stability, and cooperation with other nations. Its anti-war geopolitical agenda stands up in sharp contrast to that of the United States, NATO, and the Israeli regime. Hardline U.S. policies towards Iran are expected to continue at least largely unchanged if the Biden-Harris administration succeeds that of Donald Trump. In public remarks and opinion editorials, Antony Blinken supports the Russiagate hoax, earlier saying, Trump's collusion with Russia's plans is really striking. Blinken claimed, Putin managed to sow doubt about our electoral system. He managed to help defeat the candidate that he despised, Hillary Clinton. He managed to get the first National Security Advisor, John Bolton, fired. He added, every step along the way, either knowingly or not, wittingly or not, Donald Trump has aided and abetted this effort by delegitimizing our institutions and our leaders. Whenever hostile claims are made about Russia and other independent nations on the US target list for regime change, supportive evidence is absent, rendering them baseless.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on November 3, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference on the occasion of the birthday anniversaries of the Holy Prophet of Islam and Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq. Greetings be upon them. And which coincides this year with the National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance and Unity Week. Imam's great initiative in naming Unity Week.
As for Unity Week, today, more than ever, the importance of Imam's initiative has become clear. Many officials in Islamic countries did not understand how important the message was. In other words, they tended to ignore it because of their various ulterior motives. However, today we understand how important the message was. The events that have taken place today, the various differences that exist among Islamic countries, and the horrible incidents that have taken place in some regional countries, including in Syria, in Iraq, and at a certain point in time in Libya, in Yemen, and in Afghanistan, help us understand how important the unity of the world of Islam was and how precious the solidarity of the Islamic Ummah was, as announced and demanded by Imam Khomeini. If that unity had existed, many of these incidents would not have occurred. What exists in the world of Islam today, particularly in a certain part of it in the region, is really disastrous. They undermine the issue of Palestine. They have made the treacherous and despicable move to normalize their relations with the Zionists. All these are the outcomes of lack of unity in the world of Islam.
Your light and love, polar sea, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
For the sake of appearances and based on corrupt and false motives, such an indecent act was committed, which culminated in the violation of the Palestinian nation's rights at the hands of certain people. Of course, the Palestinian cause cannot end, and they're too small to be able to put an end to this matter. The Palestinian cause will continue to thrive. Palestine will become Palestine, and the Zionist regime will be destroyed. There is no doubt about this. However, they are creating obstacles on the way of this cause within the scope of their capabilities. One of the things that they have done is to establish relations with that murderous and criminal usurper, the Zionist regime.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.